change the world together. Welcome to the Snapcast, the podcast for all nonprofit professionals, bringing you interviews and amazing ideas for nonprofit leaders.
Hello, my friends. This is Mickey Desai, your host for this episode of the Nonprofit Snapcast. This is a very special episode that I got to do with Tony Martinetti of Nonprofit Radio. Our guests were Heidi Bierick and Pete Clay. Heidi is with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, and Pete Clay has done a prior episode with the Nonprofit Snapcast on cybersecurity and doing cybersecurity on a budget. We talked about how domestic terrorism is a threat to your nonprofit and what you can do to minimize the risks. I thought the conversation was pretty compelling and hope you enjoy it. Here it is.
It's my pleasure to first welcome Mickey Desai. Mickey and I are co-hosting this week's show. His podcast is Nonprofit Snapcast. He invented the Nonprofit Snapshot, a micro-assessment and dashboard for nonprofits. Mickey is at NP Snapshot, and the company is at nonprofitsnapshot.org. Mickey, it's a pleasure to co-host with you. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Tony. Glad to be here today.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for coming up with this idea. Thank you.
It was a team effort.
It was your idea. I adopted it immediately. I'll give you that. But it was your. I was ready. I jumped on it, but it was your idea originally.
Right.
Heidi Bierick, also with us. She is co-founder and chief strategy officer at Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. She's an expert on American and European extremist movements, including white supremacy, nativism, anti-Semitism, and anti-government movements. She has appeared repeatedly on major television networks and in documentaries and radio programs, and now a podcast, Exploring Extremism. Heidi led the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, the premier organization tracking hate and anti-government movements in the United States. She's at Heidi Bierick, B-E-I-R-I-C-H, and her organization is at globalextremism.org. Heidi, it's very good to have you. Thanks for being with me and Mickey.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
A pleasure. And Pete Clay, has a 25-year career in cybersecurity. He has served as Chief Information Security Officer, CISO, for three very different organizations, as a consultant to large international financial organizations, including the World Bank, and multiple U.S. federal agencies. He's founder of CyberOps, at CyberOps, that's OPZ, CyberOPZ.com. Pete, welcome to
Thank you, Tony.
Radio and Nonprofit Snapcast.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Pleasure. Thank you for doing this with us. Heidi, I got a first question for you. Insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, insurrection by Redditors against a Wall Street hedge fund that bet against GameStop and AMC stock. These two things, monumental, happened within a month of each other in January and February. Are nonprofits potential targets of insurrection?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that nonprofits could ultimately be targets in this kind of mob action, like you saw in particular off of Reddit related to the GameStop stocks. You know, when nonprofits write about, advocate about things that folks don't like, this is probably the most likely way that you're going to see an attack come. And I can just tell you from my years at the Southern Poverty Law Center, my work now at the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, while I was at SPLC and now, we write a lot about the kinds of people that were involved in the insurrection at the Capitol. And when you do that, you are absolutely going to get harassed online, doxxed online, targeted online, fake news produced about you online. You can have mass hits to your Twitter feed from people attacking you. And, you know, there are a lot of other things that can happen, including attempts to, you know, disrupt your web services, attack your payment system. So it's more serious than just somebody saying, you know, that I'm a communist liberal and should die, right? They can actually attack the systems that the nonprofit relies on to function. And there are real world effects because sometimes there is a need for security in real life as if these things become threatening enough. And it can include up to death threats, which we received many, many times, especially while I was at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah. Yeah. It's incredible. And you're right. The attacks could be physical. They could be virtual. They could be reputational. And I want to broaden it too. I think I want folks to realize that it doesn't have to be that you're doing controversial work. like you are, you know, fighting extremism and nationalism, white supremacy. It could just be something that a group or even a person just doesn't like. Like you could be doing environmental work, or you could be feeding the homeless, and somebody in your community feels that your efforts are, your work is worthless and should be devoted to something that person thinks is important. It doesn't even have to be controversial, like gun violence or gun control or Planned Parenthood or something, right? I mean,
no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, nowadays with this technology, your fingertips, right? The ability to Zoom bomb people, you know, send them hateful direct messages, reply to tweets online, that any person really can have access to this and engage in it so quickly before you could even report it, right? To like a Twitter or a Facebook. Anybody can be maligned this way. Also, it's very easy to put up fake websites, right, that target someone with a bunch of falsehoods. You could, you know, a YouTube video can go up in seconds, or on TikTok. So yeah, anybody who doesn't like what you're doing, and I suppose this would apply to corporations and all kinds of things, has at their fingertips the ability to smear you, smear your work, you know, libel you, all kinds of, and threaten you. So that's right. You don't even have to be doing something controversial. If one person or a group of people, like you saw with the coordinated activities off of Reddit, decide you're their target, well, this is very easy to do to somebody.
Yeah. And the one person, we can look at Walmart in El Paso, the synagogue in Pittsburgh, other examples, the black church mass murder in South Carolina, all individual actors. Mickey, I want to turn it over to you. What do you want to do? What do you want to ask?
Please. Well, I have a number of questions actually, but I'm trying to actually narrow it down to one. And I don't know who exactly to address this to, because I think it applies to both. Heidi, in your experience, the two questions that I kind of wanted to touch on briefly are, do you have any quick insights into what leads people to extremist behaviors? And is there a way to separate and quantify the odds of real life crime versus cybercrime?
Those are good, tough questions, Mickey. honestly, we don't really have great research on what causes one person to become an extremist who's exposed to a whole bunch of terrible ideas and somebody else doesn't necessarily go down that path. You know, Tony just mentioned the attacks in Pittsburgh and in El Paso and in Charleston. In those cases, each of those individuals had imbibed a bunch of white supremacist ideas. That's what led to them to commit those attacks. But those particular ideas, sadly, are rampant across a lot of different social media and websites. So the question becomes, why Dylan Roof in Charleston, right? Why the guy in Pittsburgh? Why does this particular individual snap? You know, there are a lot of theories, especially coming out of the FBI's behavioral unit, on people who collect grievances, perhaps have domestic violence in their past, or alternatively, in many cases, come from broken families. So they look to white supremacy as a way to sort of replace that in a way that's similar to maybe kids joining gangs, right? Kids of color. But it's the data is not very sophisticated and we don't know a lot about it. And this is part of the reason why the federal government looks like it's going to be pouring some serious money into research on this front so we can tease these things out better. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done with, you know, big online data sets to try to figure out what are the triggers. Look, the one thing we know is that in the last few years, the ranks of white supremacists have grown and the age of the people joining them has been falling. So very young, particularly white males, are getting sucked into this universe. And so, you know, there's something about the online thing that has more of an impact than when you used to experience these ideas out in the real world. There's something going on there that's particularly dangerous. Okay, Mickey, now I've half forgotten what your second question was. Can you tell me again?
I do that all the time. I'm so bad with two-part questions. I got to write it down or I have to do the exact same thing. What was the other part?
The other part is there a separation? Can you measure the fractions between real-life in-person crime versus cybercrime?
What motivates it? Is that what you're saying?
Frequency of incidents.
Oh, gosh.
That's kind of redundant, but yes.
Well, I mean, the big thing that I spend time studying is how the online moves to the offline, right? So how is it that it triggers domestic terrorist attacks, basically? And so we've already mentioned a few of the big ones here. We could also talk about Christchurch, New Zealand attacks. There were two attacks in Germany in the last year driven by white supremacy. I mean, the one thing I can tell you we know is there's a particular type of propaganda. It's called the Great Replacement. What it argues is that white people are being genocided in their home countries. I know this sounds lunatic, but this is what these people believe, and being replaced by, you know, Muslims, immigrants, non-white folks. Often Jews are blamed for orchestrating this whole business. That particular ideology has motivated a ton of terrorist attacks. So we know that. But, you know, we could say the same thing about QAnon, right? This kooky conspiracy about Democrats involved in child sex trafficking. No basis in reality. Didn't exist 5 years ago. And last year, the FBI labeled that particular conspiracy theory as violence inducing. And we saw a lot of QAnon supporters at the Capitol on January 6th during the insurgency there. So we know some things trigger more violence than other things. But again, I think all of this requires a lot more research. And, you know, we've only had this social media capability for a very short period of time. So it's not surprising that we're kind of behind the eight ball in figuring all of this out.
Heidi, I wanted to follow up with you on accelerationism and what that's about. But let's bring Pete Clay in. Pete, what worries you on the cyber side? I mean, I'm not sure nonprofits are properly invested in cybersecurity, thinking about it. Have a plan. What concerns you around nonprofits and cyber?
Tony, let's keep it focused, first of all, on Heidi, right? Heidi, I live 10 miles outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. So I kind of understand. And it's fascinating to me because exacerbating that is one person can appear to be 10,000, right, online. And so when you start to look at what accelerates in these groups, you know, there's several fascinating studies that were done about the early days of WikiLeaks, where it looked like there were tens, hundreds, and thousands of people that were working on WikiLeaks, and it was two guys, right? And the same thing with these movements. And one of the attractions of the movement is I'm with people that think like I do. You don't know if it's one person or 10 people or 1,000 people, right? It's just people that think like I do. So all of those things, and Heidi, you know, please protect yourself. You know how to do it, but protect yourself online, right? Because what we've seen, and I've gotten pulled into several of the conversations here locally, people long after Charlottesville were over were getting doxxed and having fake news done. And as the trials played out locally and the Antifa supporters would show up at the trials, this stuff just kept going on for years here. And so it's so important to understand, even before you talk about organizational protection, it's so important to understand how to protect yourself, right? And it really starts from a personal protection standpoint of understanding that basically everything that you do online is tracked somewhere by someone. And if that sounds really big brotherish, I don't mean to alarm people, but, you know, I was just reading an article a little bit earlier today that says now that 2/3 of all emails have tracking software, tracking pixels built into them. So they know when they were open, they know how long somebody looked at them, they know where the IP address was, and all of those sorts of things. And so for anybody in Heidi's line of work, it's so incredibly important to practice good information security protection, because first of all, the work that she's doing is so incredibly important. But then second of all, just to protect herself from online hysteria and nonsense turning into real world threats. And so all of those things can apply to particularly for nonprofits that engage in let's call them the anti-hate approach to the world. If you're going to annoy somebody, you have to have more than just antivirus and, you know, a cousin Bob that kind of does something for somebody to kind of protect you, because it is so simple the vast majority of attacks today are automated attacks that somebody launched days ago. They may not even be pointed at you, but because you have a weakness they can exploit, they'll run the attack through automatically. They'll pull the information and then figure out what to do with it and how to monetize it later. And that goes for individuals or small nonprofits or big companies. So all of those things kind of come into this one space together.
So Pete, you need to have protections built. I mean, you need to have someone in your organization focused on this. And again, it's not only the, you know, the folks doing important work like Heidi is doing. I mean, it could be an organization that's to 99.5% of us would be just mundane work helping in the community, but somebody in the community doesn't like it.
Well,
I think the potential threat is broad.
The potential threat is huge because, again, what Heidi is doing in Heidi, I'm not trying to use you as an object lesson, but you are a lightning rod in this sense, right? Because the vast majority of nonprofits aren't going to be specifically targeted. You don't have to annoy anybody to be the victim of a cyber attack. You just have to have the wrong configuration in place to be the victim of a cyber attack.
And it may make sense to describe exactly the difference between an opportunistic cyber crime versus a targeted cyber crime. You know, Pete, if I'm not mistaken, you're talking about someone who's basically just pinging tons of IPs to figure out where the vulnerabilities are, and then they can come back later and exploit them versus an activist or an extremist out there who is specifically targeting an entity that they don't like in order to damage their system or to take their money or something like that. Is there a difference between the way those two things are perpetrated?
Tony, Mickey, and again, Desai right there, man. I'm just going to use that. I've been Desai right there. I can scan the entire internet, every connected device on the internet for vulnerability in 45 minutes from the desktop that I'm sitting at.
Can.
Right. Yeah. Anybody can. You can. Mm-hmm. Any of us can, right? Every 45 minutes. What that means is, if I have knowledge and can do some very, very simple things, and in fact, you can actually buy kits for ranging from a couple hundred dollars for not very good ones to a couple thousand dollars for some pretty good ones that will actually take the information from that scanning and plug it into and just automate an attack that just works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And it just runs continuously. It's completely non-personal. If you have this vulnerability that it can exploit, it will exploit it, bring the information back, and do whatever it's going to be done with it, right? That's a very different thing than when you see somebody, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center. I was doing some research about 10 years ago, and the Southern Poverty Law Center website was one of the top 15 most attacked websites on the entire internet. And it was continuous. It was a continuous barrage. It was a continuous everything. Yeah, that's got those automated attacks in there, but it's far more dangerous because people that understand how to break into systems are actively trying to take the information that they get from the Southern Poverty Law Center or from a website that they don't like, and they're actively using it to try to break in to deface the website, to change messaging on the website, to get inside the system, to exploit sensitive information. And so all of those things are happening on an ongoing basis. And where the cybersecurity markets have not done a good job is there are way too many products that are being sold out there as just buy our stuff and you don't have to worry about this anymore. There is no product in the world that's a true statement for. You have to take multiple products and kind of put them in the right position with the right architecture to be able to protect yourself. There are some that can cut a lot of risk. A good firewall, it's almost worth its weight in gold if it's properly configured and monitored. Because the other thing that we see all the time is when we go in and we look after these great big data breaches, you can almost write, it's almost like a metronome at this point. such and such company had a data breach. Don't know what happened. Here are the suspects that possibly broke into it, because we all want to think some nation state's actually breaking into everything, when most of the time it's honestly something like one of those automated attacks that did something. Oh, the alerts all went off. Nobody responded to the alerts. If your fire alarm goes off and you don't respond to the fire alarm, it's kind of on you at that point, right? So what's really critical in cybersecurity is not just buying some products, but it's having people that are at least understand how to respond to the alerts and are responsible for protecting the organization as it stands. It also gets a lot more complex, because a lot of those services that Heidi talked about earlier are hosted and served by a different company. And you have to understand where their security stops and where your security has to begin.
Pete, what kind of person is a nonprofit looking for? I know the listeners to Nonprofit Radio, and I imagine that's true for Mickey's show as well, Nonprofit Snapcast. You know, they're small shops. They're not going to have they may not even have a director of information technology, let alone they're certainly not going to have a chief information security officer. What are they searching for? What kind of expert are they looking for to help to advise them?
So what they're looking for is, first of all, one of the fastest growing areas right now in cybersecurity is, for the first time in my 25-year career, cybersecurity experts are starting to show up on boards of directors, right? Either as advisors to boards or as board members themselves, because it's considered to be critical. This is happening in the Fortune 500 as well as from much smaller companies. The second thing is to sit down and talk to your managed service provider. If you don't have any of your IT done in-house, talk to the people that are providing your managed security, or managed service provider, if they're providing your laptops and your endpoints. Chances are they've got some stuff that they can help you with at that particular point. What we found and the gap that we're really filling in that market is, we take big company information. I don't want to turn it into a commercial. We take big company enterprise level cybersecurity capabilities, and we deliver those to small companies at a very effective price. And so we are trying to make it as simple as possible for people to do the right thing. But before you go hire anybody, before you go do anything, there is one thing that you can do that will take a ton of risk out. And that is train your people in cybersecurity. There's a ton of stuff on YouTube. There's a ton of free training out there. And point after point after point, before you buy firewalls and antivirus and endpoint protection and all of this stuff, train your people. Because training your people has the most positive impact on reducing your cybersecurity risk that you can possibly imagine.
Mickey, you got something? I don't want to.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I want to ask Heidi again. There's a number of questions I think I want to ask you that sort of hinge upon, how did you get into this area of interest? What inspired you to get into intelligence of this nature?
Sure. Let me just say something about what Pete just said.
Sure.
On the training your people. I got to tell you that, especially when I was at SPLC, that's where we found a lot of the major attacks coming in. Like, in other words, if people hadn't been known, don't click on this thing, don't go open this thing, don't do this thing, it's like we would have just been opening ourselves up to, and you're right, these many, many attacks that we were constantly sustaining. So I'm reminding myself of all the little trainings they made me do there and actually how smart it was, even though I might have been annoyed by them at the time. Okay. Mickey, how did I get into this? It wasn't entirely planned. I was working on a PhD. I'd been studying fascist movements in Europe for a really long time and in Latin America. And I was at Purdue University and I thought I was going to become a professor. And in my sort of job hunt that first year, I ended up, for a bunch of not interesting circumstances, taking an internship at the SPLC. And so I literally, during my time there, I did every single job in the department that I was in, right? Started as an intern, then was a staff writer, you know, up, up and up. And what I found when I went to work there is, first of all, I'd always had this, visceral dislike of fascist movements, of white supremacy, of what it does to people, perverts democracies. You know, obviously it's one of the worst ideas ever come up by, humankind.
Right.
And I found the fact that I was in doing activist work. In other words, I was there to expose these groups, write about them, let the public know about them, law enforcement know about them. And if I could do something to tamp down their activities, I found that just so much more satisfying than writing academic publications that may have been important, but didn't have that kind of real world impact. So I sort of got hooked on, what good nonprofits do, no matter what they're into, which is impact, right? Whether that's feeding people or housing people, or it's trying to, break up white supremacy as a threat, to Americans, in this case at SPLC. So that's what really hooked me on it. And because I had, a lot of background on these kinds of people, these movements, these groups, it was easy for me to hit the ground running. And that's why I stayed. I mean, it was that satisfaction of knowing, okay, we've just written an expose on this really vile group that celebrates the Confederacy and is growing at a very fast clip. This is slowing down their membership drives. Or we have found information on criminal activity by a particular group and we've handed it off to law enforcement and they're going to take care of it. And that means fewer, domestic terror incidents or hate crimes or whatever the case might be down the road. And the other thing that was really interesting about it, and I should say the Anti-Defamation League does a lot of this similar kind of work. There are other groups that do it, was that at that time, so I got to the Law Center in 1999 and 2001, of course, were the horrible terrorist attacks, 9/11. At that time, people weren't really watching white supremacy and it was metastasizing and growing as we all focused, understandably so, on the threat coming from, the Middle East and Al-Qaeda and so on. And I think back to that time, and I think if the SPLC and the ADL and some others weren't doing that work, we would have known nothing about it. I mean, there would have literally been nobody paying attention to these movements at that time. And that would have been an absolute tragedy. So, I'm really proud of having been able to do that work and keep doing that work now. But it was the impact part, the ability to make something happen that would make life easier on others, that really kept me in the game.
The reason I ask is, coming from my own background in mental health, we learn early on that if you're in a position to be touching the darker side of human nature, the shadow side, as some people call it, with any sense of regularity, then that is a good recipe for burnout unless you know how to really deal with that. You're in a position to see the same thing on a societal level. How did you not burn out?
Well, I did take a lot of vacations, I will admit. And sometimes you just had to take a break from the material. I mean, for some people, it's harder than for other people, right? When you're watching racist material all day long or anti-Semitism, whatever the horrible thing may be, it can get to you. I will say that once I'd made the decision last fall to leave the center and start this new organization to focus on transnational white supremacy, which is what it is. I took like 4 months off. I mean, I felt like I'd been running a marathon in particular since Donald Trump ran for office in 2015. And I did take a chunk of time off. And it's a legitimate thing. I mean, I think a lot of organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center and others who monitor this information are starting to realize that maybe this isn't something you should be doing 40 hours a week, right? You need to have breaks. You need to have access to therapy if you need it. And that it would be good to spend some of your time working on something positive, right? As opposed to viewing negative things all the time. I've actually heard questions. I've had a lot of people ask me, like, for example, there's an organization called Hope Not Hate in the UK that tracks the same kind of extremism over there. And we've all had conversations in the last year saying, well, what is it that you do for your staff, right? How do you protect your staff? How do you make sure it's sustainable, that you don't want burnout. So it's really important, Mickey. And honestly, it's a conversation that I never heard the first decade and a half that I was doing this work. It's as though the issue didn't exist, right? Or at least in this sector, it didn't exist. And now I'm glad that it is talked about.
Right. Well, and you led up exactly to the point that I was hoping you'd make, which was, at least we kind of touched on it, the acknowledging that the burnout is there, but being burnt out can make you a little more vulnerable to harm, especially if you're in a personal position where your actual physical safety is on the line. Because I think it does. I think it dulls your awareness, and I think it makes you a little bit careless in the way that you might conduct yourself. And I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong. I could be completely off base with that.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I don't think there's been enough sort of thinking about what the impact is of being exposed to this. What's interesting is that you're now seeing it from moderators on the big social media sites, right? There was a big lawsuit announced yesterday by Facebook moderators who feel that they've suffered considerable harms. Now, they, unlike what my experience was, they don't get the positive experience to know that what they're doing is probably helping people, right? They're just looking at heinous material of all kinds, right? Involving children. I mean, it's not just about hate material, and taking it down and not really maybe getting the satisfaction of feeling like it's achieving something. But we just haven't talked about it enough. There's probably a callousness that gets, you know, it probably reduces your empathy and sympathy in many ways. So there's a lot of side effects that we need to know more about, especially when it comes to really gross content. And there's a lot of parts of the world where, you know, nowadays in nonprofits, you're seeing that stuff, even if that's not what you're monitoring, you may be subjected to it.
Right.
Heidi, I experienced something like that myself in the days when Richard Spencer and white supremacy were more talked about than they are now. What was that, like, I guess 2017, 2018, something like that. I started listening to a podcast called The Daily Shoah.
That's a bad one.
Yeah. Yeah. The Shoah, nobody knows it, or very few people know this. The Shoah is the Hebrew word for the Holocaust. So the name of the show is The Daily Holocaust. And I wanted to get to know, you know, what these people, what do they talk about? How do they rationalize their thinking? Who are these folks besides Richard Spencer? And I guess I binge listened for like a weekend or something, but I had to put it down for a couple of weeks because it's so hateful and hurtful. I experienced that personally. I as much as I was still curious, and I did go back to it, but you know, like you're saying, you know, you took a 4-month break. Your work is a lot more intense than mine, but just on my little microcosmic way, listening to one podcast for a bunch of hours, I couldn't take it any longer. I had to put it away for a couple of weeks.
I have a colleague, not named to be mentioned, who suffered some serious post-traumatic stress after watching, you might remember the Christchurch attacks at the two mosques where 51 people were killed, were run on Facebook Live, right? The guy live streamed this. And I have a friend who was, of course, we were monitoring these attacks as they were happening, right, at the Southern Poverty Law Center. And he told me for weeks and weeks after, because we watched the video multiple times, right, to figure out what we could see was going on here. Were there more attackers, et cetera, et cetera. He said he was having nightmares. I mean, it really deeply, deeply affected him, which we shouldn't be surprised by, right? I mean, and there's probably, I mean, I think about the victims in some of these attacks or the populations who are targeted by them, what that must feel like. I can't even imagine. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the nonprofit thread. I did want to ask you about accelerationism. What that movement is and how that could potentially be a threat to the nonprofit order.
Well, accelerationists who are typically neo-Nazis, there's a couple big groups that people may have heard of. The Base, that's the English translation for Al-Qaeda, actually, even though they're Nazis. Atomwaffen, which is a group named, that means atomic weapons in German. What's problematic about these groups in particular is that what they mean when they say they're accelerationists is their goal is to accelerate the end of democracies or social systems or social orders. They want to actually blow them up, rip them down, destroy them, replace them with, you know, something neo-fascist or whatever their dark fantasies might be. And they're involved in a ton of violence. Had dozens of them arrested for plots involving murder, attempted murders, killings. I mean, it's really, really bad stuff. If you end up in the sights of somebody like that, you know, it's going to cost you. I mean, these are online movements. I mean, one thing I'm thinking about when Pete was talking about being targeted, these are not numbskulls when it comes to web technologies. These are people who are early adopters. They understand their messaging has to get out online. They know how to use tools and all kinds of things to affect the work of nonprofits and others who they don't like. They dislike everybody that they perceive to be on the left, right? So this isn't just about doing anti-hate work. It could be any kind of entity that's doing what I would consider social justice work or you know, work for the public good, especially if you're something like Black Lives Matters, you could easily be a target of these people. And they're pretty scary. You know, probably one of the ugliest websites in the country. It's kind of, they advertise the Daily Show as called Daily Stormer, right? Named after a Nazi newspaper. Their webmaster is on the run living in Transnistria, part kind of an unregulated part of Moldova. And he runs a bunch of American websites, and he orchestrated attacks where he took over fax machines in universities around the world and put out anti-Semitic propaganda. This guy's clever. He's clever. And he's probably capable of doing just about anything if he sets his mind to it online.
Pete, we should go back to you.
No, you shouldn't. What Heidi is talking about.
Well,
Tony, I appreciate it, man. I really do.
It's important for groups to know that, you know, they got to protect themselves online and how to do it.
Yeah, but I'm also telling you that the map over my back right there, right, is Oxford University. Spent my junior year there, right? My fascination was Germany, 1923. Where did all this stuff start? And, you know, also as a transplanted, you know, grew up overseas and grew up other places. And so when we moved to the American South, kind of adopted the whole mythology of the Confederacy and states' rights, not the slavery part of it, but the whole mythology of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and all the rest of that. And I'm such a history freak. I won all of those arguments for 30 years, right? It was all about states' rights. It was all about this stuff. And I ran into a UVA professor, and over the course of about a 3-hour meal, just got totally demolished in every argument that I made. And so it's a fascinating concept that suddenly we have the Confederacy, which morphed in about 1890 because they basically rewrote it in the Arthurian legend, right? Which is what we all learned in high school and college growing up. But now it's been grafted onto nothing but pure Nazism, right, moving forward. And how that happened and how that's happening online, I think is actually one of the great stories of the out of the military. In talking to friends, they can't tell the difference between the recruitment techniques used by ISIS and used by Al-Qaeda and used by the white supremacists. The techniques are exactly the same with the same results. This is what's going to determine the outcome of our democracy in the next 25 years.
If I can steer us back to some practical things that nonprofits can do to contend with this, you know, we've sort of been dancing around the issue of awareness of the magnitude of the problem and the various things that nonprofits might experience. Pete and I did a really excellent short Snapcast episode on doing cybersecurity on a budget, so I don't want to rehash that. But maybe it does make sense to sort of touch on some basic things, Pete. If we're talking about nonprofits, that probably the vast majority of nonprofits are not going to be specifically targeted for their work or their ideology. Probably the vast majority of nonprofits might become a victim of opportunistic crime. But is the effort to defend themselves, are the steps that those nonprofits can take the same?
The steps are the same. First of all, figure out what is the least amount of IT you can use to do your job and do it well and do it effectively, right? So if you don't have to turn everything on with your machines, the idea is what is the minimum I can use? Because the less you use, the fewer of those automated attacks you're going to get hit with, okay? The second piece of it is passwords aren't terribly useful anymore, okay? We used to be really, really silly people, and we would run around and tell people you have to have a 12-character password with upper and lower case and special characters and all the rest of this stuff, and you have to change it between every 45 and 90 days and all the rest of that stuff. And what we realized was we drove people insane, and they quit listening to information security people like me talk, right, because we were snatching their lives away from them. what the bad guys were doing was they were capturing those password files and just replaying the entire hash. They don't even decrypt them anymore. So you need to have two-factor authentication for your bank account and for any of your communications, right? Any of your personal communications, because that's where those risks are. And if you're, multi-factor authentication in some cases now with really good stuff can be biometric, where you type in your password and then they just use the biometrics on your phone or whatever other devices out there, or cameras and everything else. And we're seeing huge leaps forward in that stuff going on. Finally, you have to get past the idea of thinking that hackers are these hoodie wearing geniuses that can get into anything at any point, at any time in the world, right? There are people that work for nation states that what they do looks like magic, right? They're all backed by huge research departments and huge capabilities that it takes a nation state to do that level of research. The stuff that's come out about the solar winds attacks in the last couple of days, make no mistake. Yes, they may have found a very simple password that an intern left years and years and years ago. By the way, that is the most terminally stupid excuse ever given by a CEO for losing a major hack, right? Let's blame the intern. But the guys that did that attack and the ramifications of it were backed by literally hundreds, if not thousands, of very highly trained engineers. Those guys are typically not coming after you unless you're Heidi. If you're Heidi, they may be coming after you. But if you use multi-factor authentication and you patch your machines and you use good antivirus and things like that, do those things that are available to you, you're going to stop the vast majority of those attacks. And then the way you deal with those attacks that just standard tools aren't going to stop is you become what's called resilient. Okay. Resilience, which means I have good backups of my systems. You want to take over my laptop? Great. Erase everything, restore from backup. I'm back up and running in a couple hours. You haven't stopped me. Okay. And those are the important steps for any nonprofit out there to kind of put together and to really think about.
That's cool. Pete, I'm not taking out the part where you pledged to have Heidi's back. You're the information security guy with a heart. How can I take that out?
I'm just telling you, Heidi. I got to meet one of my heroes today, and I didn't even know Heidi's name. I'm dead serious. That stuff is critical.
It's evidence of humanity. We're not cutting that out.
Thank you. No, I'm a cybersecurity guy. I'm not human.
We need
bite your tongue.
We need all the evidence we can get for humanity.
So
no.
Can Vicky, I ask, what do you think? I think you're right. I think Pete has the vapors and we need to keep that in. Okay.
No.
Thank you, Pete. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, it's appreciated. You got a fan and a follower. and dead serious. If you need help, just reach out. We got your back.
Okay.
Well,
Heidi, my only challenge is I know how they do it. So it's really hard for me not to do it to them.
Oh, he's vindictive. Okay. Wow. He's got a heart, but he's vindictive.
Yes.
Ooh, double edge.
That sounds effective. Effective, not vindictive.
All right.
Capable.
Stay friends with him.
I have one quick question for Heidi, though. I mean, we've sort of talked about a ton of cybercrime and how to prepare for and deal with that. But what if you become the target of in life, offline, physical violence? How does a nonprofit decide that their risk for that is significant enough that they should do something about it? And then what should they do about it?
Okay, well, I'm not the expert at where the threshold exists, but I can tell you that when I was at the SPLC, there were a handful of people who were the targets because we were sort of the faces of the organization, right? Anybody who was doing media would be in that position, including my colleagues who are still there right now, right, that are doing media against these kinds of folks. We brought in outside security experts with our security team to take a look at the volume of threats and the level of threats. They spent a lot of time looking at sort of almost like when you hear that chatter in Al-Qaeda is increasing, right? And that would be a time when there might be a possible terrorist attack. You know, you hear the government say that. We looked at those same sorts of trends. And we had a very close relationship with the FBI field office in Montgomery, Alabama, and where our other offices were, so that we were constantly sending in threats and material. And we had very good protocols around bomb threats and other kinds of threats. These were just, we had to train people, just like Pete was talking about, you know, protecting yourself with all this stuff online. There were trainings that were required for that. And if somebody was, you know, very prominent, maybe this is a lawyer in a case, right, against a hate group, and so their face is plastered everywhere at a particular time, and the chatter was going up, there were times when we actually had to put physical security on people as a measure. But I wasn't really the expert who decided where that threshold was, but it was a proactive thing to do. And I think anybody who's involved in activities that are seen as controversial or hated by a group of people, you know, I don't know if it's right, left, or center. I don't care where you're coming from. But if you're in that kind of basket where you're going to face those kinds of threats, you really have to think about that physical security. And there are differences between material posted online that's demeaning or ugly or vile and what is a direct threat. And you have to really keep your eye on that. Like, I remember at one point I got mailings at my home in Montgomery from Klansmen that were very cryptic and weird. That was a far more serious situation than people, you know, saying mean things about me on, you know, on Twitter. So, you know, those are all, but I would say, you know, you need to talk to security professionals or at least local law enforcement, have a good relationship with local law enforcement. If you're doing work that could lead to offline harms, right, basically.
Yeah. So I should invite my beat cops over for breakfast every once in a while.
Can't hurt, right?
I was going to ask about not only local, but I don't know, FBI or Department of Homeland Security. I mean, depending on your visibility.
Well, FBI is probably your best bet when it comes to threats in the world that I was in, because it's also their responsibility to take care of domestic terrorism and extremism and whatnot, right? So they had a knowledge, like the local SAC knew a lot about the movement. It might be different depending on where you are in the country. We also did, you know, I still did law enforcement training on extremism. So we had a lot of contacts in federal agencies. We had good access, actually, to the people who knew these movements and understood the threat, which was lucky. But, you know, I've known people, I knew some folks who were working in immigrants' rights in Maryland who got vicious, vicious threats, you know, by people who despise immigrants, despise Latinos, and so on. And they didn't have as good of access. And there were many, many times, over the years that I've been reached out to by groups like that saying, what should I do? And it's shocking, actually, that people don't even know that the first thing you should do is pick up the phone, call your local law enforcement, call the FBI, and preserve the evidence. It's amazing how often people delete threatening emails, threatening everything, direct messages and voicemails. And you should never do that. You've got to collect that evidence and you've got to let law enforcement know.
Heidi, what's a SAC? You mentioned, I have Jargon Jail on nonprofit radio. What's a, you're dropping?
Special agent in charge, sort of the head honcho in the Montgomery FBI office.
Oh, in a regional office, special agent in charge. Okay, thank you. All right.
Jargon Jail. That's interesting.
Yeah, we don't like jargon. What do you think, Mickey? We tap these two experts?
Yeah. You know, I don't think I want to abuse them anymore. But it's up to you. I'll defer to you if you have anything you want to touch. I think this has been a really good conversation.
I think we covered it. I think they covered it. I'll let you take us out. I just want to remind folks that they are Heidi Byrick. She's at Heidi Byrick, and her organization is at globalextremism.org. And Pete Clay, the chief information security officer, who's a human being and has a heart. You'll find his company at cyberops.com, cyberopz.com. And so I want to thank Heidi and Pete and Mickey. Thank you very much again for thinking of this. And I'll let you take us out.
Thank you, Tony. It's been a pleasure to work with you on this episode. That is Tony Martinetti with Nonprofit Radio. And I am Mickey Desai with the Nonprofit Snapcast. Thank you for being our audience today. We'll see you with another episode soon. Be safe.
To our listeners, thank you for joining us for this episode. We invite you to be a part of these conversations. If you have an idea for the program or would like to be a guest on a future episode, please drop us a line via our website, nonprofitsnapcast.org. In the meantime, we'll see you with another episode in a few days.
This has been the Snapcast. Thank you for joining us.